money. It's a time-tested concept. But cash, that is money in physical form, has it reached the end of its usefulness? Cash can be stolen, and when stolen, hard to trace. It can be counterfeited, too. Some forms of cash, like pennies and nickels, cost more than their face value to make. And cash is expensive to move around, which means all financial transactions using cash cost us more. More than what? Well, writer David Wolman argues in his book, The End of Money, that money in electronic form, whether the familiar credit card or new digital currencies like Bitcoin, is safer and more efficient to use. Is Wolman right? Well, he's our guest today on Focus, so you can ask him. And you can ask questions of University of Illinois finance professor Charles Kahn as well. He says electronic currency has its strong points, but so does the old-fashioned kind. I'm Jim Meadows. Focus begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. What is money? Is it the bills in your wallet and the coins in your pocket? Is money's true value based on the government having enough gold or other precious metal to back it up? Or is money just an idea that everyone agrees to so that trade can exist beyond the level of bartering? Well, writer David Wolman tried to live without cash for a year, not without money, but without cash. And he says that in the future, doing so will be common. Wolman argued for a cashless society in his book, The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. That book was published last year by Da Capo Press. David, welcome to Focus.
Good morning.
Quick opening question. During the period you tried to live without cash, did you miss it?
Not too often. You know, as a writer, sitting by my keyboard a lot of the time, you know, I'm not in the service industry, right? So unlike waiters, for example, who depend on cash tips, cash isn't part of my everyday operation. And so many weeks would go by when I, in fact, wouldn't think too much about it, at least in the on-the-ground sense of it. Of course, from very high up, I'm thinking about it all the time while researching and writing a book. But then I would run into some certain hiccups. There was one episode when trying to compensate the babysitter, and we were not going to convince her or her dad to open up a PayPal account on the fly. And there were a few other episodes where this kind of foray into the possible cashless future ran into some trouble. And that sort of, I think, helped me illuminate some of the problems of this idea, while also helping me brainstorm, you know, what still might have to be done if it, we're going to become a cashless society, and likewise, if that's even a good idea at all.
Okay, well, we want to get back to that a little bit later. Also with us on Focus today is Professor Charles Kahn. He holds the Fred S. Bailey Memorial Chair of Finance at the University of Illinois College of Business, and he's also currently a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, but is at pains to note that he does not represent or speak for them. According to his university webpage, Professor Kahn's current projects include an examination of arrangements for payment systems, including clearinghouses, wire transfers, and electronic monies, which sounds a lot like non-cash money to me. Professor Kahn, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
And am I right? Do these payment systems, most of them count as electronic currency or some way of payment without the physical movement of coins and bills around?
If you're talking about the big stuff, then almost all of it is. I mean, cash is a very small part of the money supply. It's a very unimportant part as far as banks' total holdings are concerned. If you're talking about the small stuff, it's still there and it's still pretty important.
Well, we welcome you to the conversation as well. If you have questions or comments about money, physical or otherwise, call in and tell us about it at 333-9455. Or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. Or toll free 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. You know, when I'm thinking about this whole discussion about whether or not to be more or less cashless, it goes down to what money is. Do we have a baseline definition of money, Professor Kahn? You have to you give students final exams on this sort of thing. So, what do you expect them to know?
Well, the problem with that is that there are going to be about four different definitions of money, and whatever the definition you use, you're probably going to find that in casual conversation, you're going to break the rules and start using them incorrectly. So let me try to be careful about this. And Mr. Waldman, I suspect, is going to have the same problem when he uses the terms. Cash will mean paper money and coins. Money itself, if you use it in economics or finance, means that stuff plus mostly checking accounts. But probably that's not the useful distinction either. The distinction that's important is what do we use to make payments with? And besides those kinds of monies, we use things that are technically not monies, but we'll call them monies as well, I suspect, like credit cards and debit cards. And for payments, those are becoming more and more and more important.
Well, what I'm wondering is, as you said, that for banks, actual movement of cash is less and less common for them. When they're moving around large amounts of money electronically, is there some actual money, whatever actual money is, backing it up somewhere so they can say, hey, there it is. It just belongs to somebody else now.
Ultimately, what they're moving around, if in the United States at least, is accounts at the Federal Reserve. So when Bank A sends $1 gazillion to Bank B, what we do is we move the funding from account Bank A at the Federal Reserve to the account of Bank B at the Federal Reserve.
So that means that the U.S. Treasury theoretically has all this money.
Nobody has all this money.
Nobody has all this money. So it is just an idea.
Yeah.
And the spell is broken.
Yes.
Down the rabbit hole we go.
Well, this goes down to, and Mr. Woolman, maybe I'm sure you wrote about this, the idea that money should be backed up by something. The Republicans had a presidential candidate. Well, not their nominee, but one of the candidates, Ron Paul, who certainly wanted to return to the gold standard, if I have things correct, which means the idea that money should be backed up by something somewhere.
Right, and that, without getting into a down in the weeds debate about a return to the gold standard, which, you know, by the way, the vast, vast, vast majority of economists will tell you that's a dangerous and bad idea. But, you know, at a simpler level for kind of launching into this conversation, you know, what's fascinating is even the way you started off this question, well, where is that money? And there's this peculiar dichotomy in modern society. By and large, we have said yes to the electronic money proposition. In other words, as Charles was saying a moment ago, most money already is zeros and ones on distant servers, bouncing between banks and Treasury or Federal Reserve or what have you. And there is still some cash out there, but it's greatly overwhelmed by all of this money in digital form. And yet, when you pause in your day-to-day, because most people are just hustling around to earn some money and pay the bills, when you take a little time to wonder about what that money is and where is it and what gives it value, you run into this strange puzzle because most of it is already electronic. And then you say to people, well, okay, should we even keep the physical stuff around? Everyone goes bananas because you're breaking the spell in an almost frightening way and reminding them that value is really conjured by us as a society, as a civil society, I might add. And I think that is what actually drew me to this topic in the first place, this inconsistency between so much digital money already in the modern era, and yet we have this 5 or 4 or 7% of the economy that's still cash-based. And so you say to everyone, well, let's wander over to the edge of the cliff and see what the deal is with this very old-fashioned thing called cash. And people sort of jump to its defense in a very emotional way.
I'm wondering, you tried living without cash for a long period of time. Did you find yourself treating money in the same way since you never saw it?
Well, you know, one thing I came face-to-face with is an idea that psychologists refer to as pain in spending. And this is why a lot of people, frankly, really loathe plastic, because economists will tell you that $100 in the form of a $100 bill is the same thing as 10 $10 bills, is the same thing, basically, as $100 on a debit card. In other words, you know, liquid assets that you could deploy to buy something. But anybody with half a brain knows that it is a lot harder to spend a nice, crisp $100 bill than it is to start spending off those tens. There's a kind of stickiness and a pain in spending to that 100, and so we hold tight to it. And so a lot of people, when they think about and worry about digital money or the quote-unquote cashless future, they say, no, I'm much more careful with my budgeting and with my finances if I'm dealing in cash. And that is a very sensitive angle on this topic. You know, Americans owe about $800 billion on their credit cards right now, completely separate from the identity theft and fraud issues. That's just debt. And so how do we answer that concern while still talking about digital money? Now, I don't think that's the end of the conversation. I think there's many ways to recreate that pain in spending with digital media. But this is one thing that I felt when I was avoiding cash, is that, you know, you're not seeing and feeling it quite as much or quite as painfully when you part with some funds in electronic form, and that that can get people in quite a pickle.
And is that true, what people say, that they are more careful when they can see the money with spending it?
It seems to be pretty clear, yes, yes.
Okay, so it's not just a perception, but that actually happens, and
There are behavioral experiments out there trying it out and seeing that it does appear to be the case. And you can also see that having that constant reminder out there of, well, yes, this is how much I've got left in my wallet, and this is how much I was planning to spend, is a help for people with their budgeting.
So unless you have the checkbook out there or the electronic account in your computer which says, in plain sight, you have this much money left,
right,
for instance.
Right, and I think that actually that's the interesting point that David was making, was that there are going to be technologies out there for doing precisely that, for keeping a gauge of, well, yes, this is how much you're spending, or a little monitor on your credit card saying, oh, this is how much you've spent in this last week. Are you sure you want to go ahead and buy this thing, this impulse purchase?
We are talking about money and its future, and specifically the cash and its future, with David Wallman, the end of money, author of The End of Money, and U of I finance professor Charles Kahn. Our phone numbers are 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. We have a caller waiting now on line one. Scott in Champaign County, good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, thank you very much. Interesting show. We have a local currency here in Champaign-Urbana, something called UC Smiles, that some people have been trying to put together for a couple of years. And it brings to mind you guys were starting sort of down the money as culture or as a cultural icon or an attribute. And so I wondered whether or not the author had any digital equivalents to things like local currencies as he did his research. You know, there was a huge system in Ithaca for many years, and now we've got this little system started in Champaign-Urbana. You know, people want to hold and fold, and it becomes, you don't throw it down in a way that is an ego, but it says to a lot of people, I'm supporting local businesses, I'm supporting retailers who are facilitating the use of these UC Smile bills, and they're kind of pretty and individualistic. And, you know, I think about my trips overseas where I always bring back some peso notes or kwacha or whatever to give to the grandkids, and how money really takes on almost like a historic value. I mean, literally as a piece of history. So there's that thought, and then there's the direct question as to whether or not there's a digital equivalent of the local currency movement. So thanks a lot for the program, and I'll listen off. Bye.
Well, thank you very much. For people who are curious about it, UC Smiles, you can find about it at their website, ucsmiles.org. It's one of these programs meant to encourage spending with local businesses. Has it ever been done? I could well imagine, say, a UC Smiles gift card that you might go to a certain place to recharge from time to time. Does anyone ever do that?
Well, yes. Actually, you have all sorts of things like that. They're not done in those terms. They're done in terms of a company that says, I want you to do business with me, so I'm going to give you a gift card. It's not much different from the same idea. And, in fact, you can find the same sorts of things online as well, where for particular uses we'll give you an arrangement that gives you a special arrangement.
And, David, I was wondering, during your cashless phase, were gift cards, were things like that something that you made use of, these devices which were specified at spending at a certain place?
They were only when I ran into them, but in the kind of conjured rule system for the book experiment, I really just took pains to never use or touch cash, as in rectangular slips of paper and little metal plugs. So gift cards were okay. And in responding again to the caller with this question of alternative currencies and alternative quasi-currencies, virtual or otherwise, this was a very big part of the book. I think it's really a sign, one of the three major signs, really, that we are living in this time of monetary revolution and innovation. There's not just where you are. There's the Ithaca Hour in New York. There's the Brixton Pound in London and Berkshires in Western Massachusetts. There's even something like Disney dollars. It sounds kind of like a cutesy example of alternative currency, but it's not so cutesy. You know, if you're a family of six in Denver saving up for the next 3 years for a trip to Walt Disney World, and you learn that using Disney dollars while there will deliver to you a 10 or 15% discount on all of your spending there, well, now it's not really such a frivolous example of what is possible with alternative currencies. Airline miles is another one that a lot of people will think about. And, of course, a very big one right now is something called Bitcoin. And this was sort of beloved only by techies up until relatively recently, and then its value sort of shot through the moon this past spring, and it's been on this wild roller coaster. And without delving into Bitcoin specifically, I think what's interesting with alternative currencies is you're seeing lots of different people coming to them for different reasons. So the caller mentioned this kind of support your local economy ethos. It's kind of like the eat local movement. Why do you want to buy a coffee table made in India with your Visa card at crateandbarrel.com and shipped to you by UPS? All that money goes elsewhere. Why not buy from the local merchant? And so people use community or alternative currencies for that purpose. But you're also seeing people come to alternative currencies because they have a lot of concern about privacy, and they don't think that through the credit card networks they're getting nearly enough privacy. And in addition to that, you're seeing a lot of people go to alternative currencies a lot like people will go to precious metals. They're worried about the stewardship of the value of the U.S. dollar. What will it buy for me, the dollar, 30 years from now? And so because they worry about inflation or hyperinflation, they seek out these alternative currencies that they believe will have a more stable long-term value.
In your own cashless experiment, you did not deal, or at least not very much, with alternative currencies?
Well, certainly not gold bullion in a backpack. That would have been cumbersome, and I can't afford it anyway. So I was kind of dabbling in them, but for me it was a lot more, my job is both to try and write something informative and then, I hope, entertaining as well. So I'm kind of seeking out some characters who are torchbearers in the alternative currency movement and also colorful people to spend time with, as opposed to really diving into it in the personal sense of it. Because the reality is, and then it's an important reality check, I cannot yet pay my utility bills with my alternative currency or buy groceries just yet, et cetera. So these things have a long way to go. Nothing's going to usurp the dollar anytime soon. But, it gives you a glimpse of what's out there on the horizon, and there are just all kinds of new value propositions for us, for the public, that I think people should be excited about, not frightened of.
Well, let's go to another caller. And on line four, Jim in Charleston, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I just wanted to make reference to a wonderful Planet Money report about money, aired maybe a year or so ago. But in that, they tell the story of the South Pacific money in the form of a large round wheel of stone, and about how they make this stone on one island and then transport it across the waves in a canoe, and one time the canoe sank. And that was no problem for them. They said, all right, the money's there, it's at the bottom of the ocean, it's yours, you can spend it. But it just highlighted to me this idea of we don't really need the physical stone or the coins or the cash to recognize that's money. And it's not necessarily a new innovation that, yeah, the money is there. It's, well, as they put it on Planet Money, Money is an illusion.
Thank you very much for the call. You know, I just Googled up the story. If you want to find it at npr.org, try writing in the title, The Island of Stone Money. We're talking about stuff used out of the Pacific island of Yap. The writer says, economists love this whole thing because it helps answer the really basic question of what money is.
Right.
And Professor Ken, is this one of these?
It's a great example for it. And it's not so much an illusion as a convention. It's an agreement. And I think that's the part that that the Yap Island Stone really
is that everybody agrees that there's certain value which is transferable. And David, for you, that's the same thing you were getting at, that you were not transferring little bits and pieces of money. You were transferring the agreement that you had this certain amount of value.
Precisely. And, you know, the same thing for you, Jim. You know, when you, if you get paid, I suspect you're not getting paid, you know, with a briefcase full of Benjamins. It's an electronic transfer from your employer to an account, or even a paper check is just representative of the value. And, you know, the Micronesian island of Yap example is as famous as it is helpful, so much so that there's even an episode when one of these stones sank in a lagoon, but it still worked just fine as money that can be used in medium of exchange, because as long as the idea of ownership can transfer successfully, then you can transact with it. And so for the owner of said stone, who was making whatever purchase, I don't know if it was a dowry or whatnot, having it parked 15 feet underwater in the lagoon was not that different than having it parked on a front lawn, and the payee was okay with that. And so the transaction went through no problem.
As long as they knew where it was and that it wasn't going anywhere.
Right, as long as they knew you know, it wouldn't be invested in mortgage-backed securities.
As long as they knew that there weren't going to be a lot more of them made next week.
Okay.
Exactly.
Let me take another call. Line 1, Remus in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering, when the speaker was not using any cash, how you dealt with tips, like hotel maids and airport shuttles?
Some tips you can do by credit card, but I don't know if tipping the maid is something you can do that way. How did you handle that sort of thing, David?
Well, it was only tricky a handful of times, you know, in large part because I would have to avoid restaurants or coffee shops, even ones I really like, if they were a cash-only environment. But obviously, with taxi drivers where I was reporting, I could pay with a credit card and I could tip with a credit card. And parenthetically, by the way, people have been, I think studies have shown that people tip more when they are paying with plastic as opposed to paying with cash. Again, because of this pain in spending thing. You don't really see it floating out of your savings or checking account, so you just give a little more. So it was with taxis and restaurants, I was just limiting myself to businesses where I could pay with plastic or pay with something else, by the way, which is important because this should not be a conversation about cash versus credit cards, because credit cards are just one form of money, or actually electronic, you know, credit money. And there are many other technologies and methods and payment tools out there that Charles can help us learn more about. So, you know, this is not some sort of shill or stick for the credit card companies. But in any case, to answer the question on the tips, I really focused on a few establishments that I could pay using plastic. And then there were a couple episodes where I'm sure that I looked like a real stiff if I was at a hotel or something like that. But by and large, I kind of kept to myself so I wouldn't end up in one of those socially awkward moments.
You know, I mentioned to my son that about your experiment, and his reaction was a big shrug. He says, "So what? I don't use cash at all either." I think the intrigue of the experiment is going to be inversely proportional to age here.
I think you're right, and in fact, things really only got dicey when I flew to India to report on the way that mobile money and mobile banking tools—this is sort of sending value by way of your phone. Are really impacting people's lives for the better in the developing world. But the reality is those technologies are just getting started. And before I even left the airport, in India. I needed some cash, and so I sort of put a time out on the the cashless year experiment, because if I'm going to pay my taxi driver or buy some bottled water or compensate my translator and all of these other things and more, I needed some cash. And so that's where, you know, there's a rather strong distinction between talking about payment methods in the developing world versus payment technologies in more developed economies.
So it could be a matter of where in the world you are, but perhaps also what strata of society that you're in. I could imagine that there are some folks, even in a big city, where it might be possible for someone of means to live cashless. For someone of less means, it would be a lot harder.
Absolutely. And in fact, this is a big part of the book, that the wealthier you are, the easier it is to avoid cash and avoid the costs of cash. And conversely, as an economist from the Gates Foundation put it to me, cash is the enemy of the poor. In other words, all of its costs become not just magnified, but more painful for you, because getting to an ATM costs money, because there are risks to carrying cash funds, because when you are in the developing world, there are so many claims on that small amount of money in your pocket, both terrible and legitimate. You know, the terrible being the abusive spouse or uncle, the legitimate claims, the short-term claims, you know, somebody's kid needs a new pair of sandals or your aunt needs some aspirin. So those funds in your pocket, it's just the cash gets spent in a way that makes it terribly difficult for the poor to save. And saving, in the kind of boring sense of financial services, saving is essential if you're trying to not just climb out of poverty but stay out. And this was really revelatory for me in reporting the project, because as someone who is not an academic, it ran so contrary to the way I assumed the world worked, which is, well, if you have more cash, that's great. And of course, if you have a mountain of cash, you're no longer poor. I get that. But lo and behold, or surprise, surprise, it turns out that things aren't as black and white as you think, and cash can be very problematic and very expensive for the poor. And to me, that seemed like a meme worth exploring.
It's really a question of alternatives. If you are rich, if you are technologically savvy, there are all sorts of alternatives out there. And so cash is just one of many things, and you use it when it's convenient. The fewer alternatives you have, the harder it is to deal with the situations where cash doesn't work well.
Well, it's time for a short break. We will be back with more about money and cash money with writer David Wolman and Professor Charles Kahn. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with David Wolman, author of The End of Money, and University of Illinois finance professor Charles Kahn. And actually, we're talking about the potential end of cash, that is, physical money, and whether we may be using it less and less in the future. Give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 to call toll-free, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have a caller waiting right now on line one, Case in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi there. I'm Charlie's neighbor and
hi, Case.
Professor at the university. I haven't read the book, so I'm speaking, you know, somewhat off, I don't know. But if we're talking about cash, currency, that is, there are various estimates. My estimate is that 80% of it is not in the country. It's overseas. It's in other countries. The Federal Reserve's estimate lately is two-thirds. So currency, and 40 years ago, the German Central Bank stopped including cash, currency, in any of their monetary policy decisions, because most of it was in Turkey, in Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
So all this stuff about what we as individuals in developed countries, because basically it's overseas in less developed countries, is sort of immaterial to the use of currency at all. Now, for those people that hold our currency and Deutschmarks and Swedish kroner everything you can think of, all the hard currencies, it's a store of value much more than it's used for transactions.
That's absolutely true. One of the things that American currency gets used for outside of the country is for being a safe haven, something that's going to retain its value more than other more problematic things that people abroad might hold. And that consideration is one of the things that makes it difficult for policymakers in the United States to deal with decisions about currency. But within the United States, it's not that much of a store of value. It's mainly just being used for small transactions.
No, that's right. But it's so little of it is in the United States. And so little of it is in, well, now we're talking about euros, but, you know. But anyway, so yeah. This really has to do with, for hard currency countries, it has to do with a substantial minority of the actual currency in circulation. Some people have argued that currency shouldn't be counted as part of the domestic money supply.
Because it's actually used as storage.
That's all the Federal Reserve's problem. Okay, I just wanted to bring that up because I think it is important. Thank you.
Case, thank you very much for calling. I was wondering about the security involved with cash. I think one point you were making in your book, David, was that the thing about cash is that people can take it, and it's a big bother to banks as well to individuals who keep money about them. But isn't there not also a security aspect with electronic money as well? I'm thinking of a recent example here in our area, and that was the hacking of card purchase data at Schnucks. That's a supermarket chain based in St. Louis. And the theft of this data, I believe it was back in March, has affected thousands of people. I seem to be one of them who have found that someone had tried to illegally use that data to put purchases on their cards. Is that as much a danger as bank robberies and holdups where cash is taken?
Well, the very short answer is of course. Financial crime in the digital realm exists and will likely exist irrespective of whether we keep cash around in the coming decades. So no one, I think, could intelligently argue that number one, otherwise, or number two, that's a good thing or that's a tolerable thing, whether it's the poor safeguards in place at that supermarket chain or with the credit and debit card issuers more generally. You know, what are they doing to protect this data? And really how we go about the relationship between our identity in the privacy sense of it and our financial lives in the future. And I think, you know, sticking to these very old-fashioned methods of just using a Social Security number and then hoping that a hospital that we give it to someday won't have an employee who's selling it on the side. I mean, we just need to do better than that, whether it's with biometric tools or what have you. But for me, the question in the book becomes, look, all different forms of money have their own liabilities, and all different payment systems have different liabilities. And cash has many attributes and qualities, but it also has a number of liabilities to it. And I wanted to illuminate some of those because cash is, it seems to me, has skirted scrutiny for so long. You know, who doesn't love a fistful of $100 bills when they are just breezily thinking about it? But in fact, when you put cash in the hot seat, you see that it has this whole host of liabilities. For example, as the caller just mentioned, something on the order, I think it's like 70% of U.S. $100 bills live overseas. As a store of value is a gentle way of putting it, I would say mostly it means lining the pockets of mafioso in Moscow and in drug dealers in Cartagena. Or the idea that we had 10,000 bank robberies over the two-year period that I was writing the book. And, of course, there's financial crime in digital realm, as I was saying, but no one could reasonably suggest that all of those thugs who carried out those 10,000 bank robberies, if we got rid of cash or even the high-value stuff that motivates the real-world crime of bank robbery, all those thugs are not going to be able to adapt and suddenly become tech savvy enough to start stealing from banks in cyberspace. So the idea for me becomes one of allocation of resources. And if we minimized cash's liabilities, minting pennies and nickels at a loss, or printing $150 bills that seem to mostly just be coveted by the underworld, well, then maybe we can shift some of those resources for protecting that currency into investigating financial crime in cyberspace, and likewise protecting our identities better from exactly what all of you have gone through with this terrible thing with the debit cards.
Well, if you look at the surveys, you're going to find that individuals argue simultaneously that cash is the safest medium and also the most dangerous medium. You can get both answers on the same time in a survey because there are multiple dimensions to what is safe and what is not safe. Yeah, cash is very good for making sure that it doesn't damage the next piece of the puzzle for you. You lose the cash, it doesn't mean that you've lost the key to the next to the rest of your wealth. On the other hand, if you lose the cash, there's any way of getting it back. No one's going to be able to distinguish one piece of cash from the next. So yes, cash has got both advantages and disadvantages in terms of security. I guess I would argue that the real danger is a monoculture. That is to say, the hard part, I think, comes from the possibility of dependence on any one particular medium rather than having, as an alternative, you've got the cash when the debit card goes down, and you've got the credit card and you've got the electronic means of payment as well. So I suspect that there's going to be some resiliency in cash just because of it's always handy to have an alternative out there.
Let's go ahead and take another call on line one, Marlene in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you. Actually, I think your guest just sort of half answered my question, and that is, I think it'd be nice to have a cashless society, but what do we do when the digital electronical system fails? What backup do we have if we don't have cash?
Well, we do have lots of different electronic backups, so I don't think that by itself is such a concern. But David makes this argument as well that we do have examples of places where enormous problems arise. Like the best example is a banker's strike in Ireland several years ago, where sort of everything broke down, and instead people just started writing IOUs to each other, and that seemed to actually work pretty well for a short period of time. So there are backups.
A massive electronic failure or power failure in regional, like we've had in the East Coast, we could survive for 3-4 days, maybe a week.
That seems to be exactly what happened in New York last fall. So yeah,
David, they had cash.
Yeah.
If we didn't have cash, would we have IOUs?
Yeah. Not in New York, but in Champaign-Urbana, we would.
David. And that's the idea of cash as being sort of the flashlight you keep in the basement or the hurricane lamp in case the power goes out. David, did you run into any of those situations where the infrastructure failed you as far as electronic money was concerned?
Well, luckily I didn't run into the experience of such a severe power outage, but the thought was definitely on my mind for a couple of reasons. One, because as the caller suggests, this is a pretty strong defense of cash or some kind of cash, or at least keeping certain denominations around for the foreseeable future. Because, you know, not just the power outage that lasts 3 or 4 days, but what if it really is 3 or 4 weeks? And this is why it was also on my radar, because I live on the West Coast, and the earthquake insurance for my home, with the premiums recently shot through the roof as new and more accurate data about the likelihood of earthquake where I live increased. So okay, up go the premiums. Okay, so I'm learning more about earthquake preparedness in my home and with my family, and not only do the Red Cross documents that you're downloading from online, they're saying, you know, you need bottled water and blankets and a can opener and food, et cetera. You must have some cash with you as well. And I think I'm not going to be, I'm not going to stand by this thesis with such vigor that I would put my family at risk or something by not having some small cash around in my emergency supply kit. However, I do think there will come a time, not 8 years from now, but 18, 28 years from now, when the costs of cash to society become so large that if the only reason to keep cash around is this colossal calamity, that we should be able to rig a system that could take care of us in the event of such a thing. And as Charles was mentioning, sometimes this does happen organically with the banker strike in Ireland, for example, and people transacting with handwritten IOUs like it was no big deal. But what if we had, and this is really just a tongue-in-cheek example, but what if we all had sort of Red Cross-issued currency in an envelope that we all are kind of instructed by emergency management not to tear into until we have gone a week without power, you know, after which that becomes sort of a legitimate medium of exchange. And again, that, frankly, if we all believe it has value, then it will have value. It will be up to us to infuse it with value and trust one another in these transactions. And again, I think it's a matter of how lopsided will the costs of cash become when we want to face the music with that kind of thing. But at the same time, I really do feel like it's a legitimate defense of keeping some cash circulating in society, at least in the short term.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions and comments for David Wolman and U of I Finance Professor Charles Kahn as we discuss the potential for a cashless society. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let me go over to line two for Lawrence in Savoy. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Well, your guests have said a few things while I've been on hold here that ameliorate some of my hostility. So I will no longer attempt to destroy your guests verbally here. I do want to speak to some sensible, or you might even want to call them conservative points, and such as being dependent on things is also a risky business, and all these electronic things need electricity. Now I rank my computer at least as high as my automobile as one of my most useful possessions, but still one can get carried away too much, and just citing all the concerns of identity theft and the social security number. Now, you know, the federal people could have done something about that a long time ago, but they're not very bright, including the ones that we elect. Your average neighbor is just as smart as these people that run things in Washington, D.C., so we should be careful. And let me add a word here about how these things can work together. And to the detriment of the greater society, this credit score business, I like to use the CRAP word to describe that. You know, if you all you people that ponied up there and went for your free credit report, and of course you had to give them all kinds of data to get that, which is their real goal, was to collect this data. And what has happened about this in the long run now, you have banks relying on credit scores. Well, once upon a time, and I lived through this as a younger person, your local banker people knew people in town, and they knew your style of life, and they knew your morals to some degree, and they knew whether you were a good credit risk, and they could decide whether to loan you money or not. And that worked much safer and saner than this electronic business that's done today. And I've probably talked long enough, and I'll hang up. Thank you. I'll stay on if any of your guests want to ask me any questions.
Any questions for Lawrence here?
Well, I think the point that again, that monocultures are probably a little less stable than some diversity in options is actually a very important one, and I would just argue that in fact the continued survival of small banks is probably going to be coming from precisely what he's saying, the ability of the guys in the small ones to have a little bit better information about the viability of a loan than a raw credit score would give you.
Okay, Lawrence, thank you very much for your call, and I have an email from Taylor who wants you to know that
that he does things pretty electronically. He does not own a checkbook, and he is careful. He monitors his accounts daily for unauthorized activity. He has strong and unique passwords for each of his accounts. His question, he's noticed a growing trend of retailers frowning on credit card sales due to the fees associated with them. What effect does this change have on business? David, I'm wondering, is that something that you see happening? Are retailers more accepting or less accepting of the use of credit cards?
Well, you know, the credit card network is so powerful and ubiquitous that, you know, their business model is hardly in jeopardy. However, I don't think you have to spend very long, especially in an urban area, to see lots of small merchants that say, cash only, please, or have a sign that says, if you're going to use a credit card, we're going to charge you an extra, whatever it would be, $1.50, $2.50, because of the fees. And, you know, there was a gargantuan lawsuit by some of the biggest retailers in the world against the credit card companies over the past few years. I'm not sure about the exact number, but the settlement from MasterCard or MasterCard and Visa was in the billions of dollars to settle the thing, which gives you some sense of the scale of what we're talking about. What I would say to that is that this is where things get really exciting, because there are a lot of upstarts that are trying to say, look, we can help you cut out the middleman, not eliminate the fees, because all there is friction to the movement of money, and there always will be. But how do we reduce that friction? And in other words, how do we reduce the cost to you as the merchant, or to you as the consumer, or both? And there's one startup that I wanted to mention, actually, that's based in Des Moines, called Dwolla. They just received like another $16 million in funding from Silicon Valley last week. And this was started by a young guy in his late 20s who became frustrated with credit card fees and all of the intermediary steps that must occur when we make a credit card payment. And he just got so mad at this that he wanted to innovate something new. And, you know, that is, first of all, it's so admirable to me. You know, as a writer, I'm kind of interested in other people's obsessions like that. And to see someone not just get interested and frustrated, but then sit down and say, okay, I'm going to redesign a better system, it's quite ambitious and admirable, I think. And in any case, they're doing quite well. And so the idea at the root of this system is that you have what's called a person-to-person payment. And so the funds can really just go from you, Jim, to me. And if the exchange is less than $10, it's free. There's no charge. And if the transaction is greater than $10, they charge us a quarter. Not a quarter like as a percentage, a quarter as in 25 cents. And that's it, a full stop. And so that's rather jarringly simple compared to what the credit card merchants offer as a quote-unquote value proposition. So I think those, you know, it's just one quick hit example, but I think those are the kind of technologies to be looking out for, because they show us that the digital money future can be even faster and have even less financial friction in it, and that's good for us.
And so the electronic transactions of today may not be the ones of tomorrow.
Oh, I think they will be incredibly different tomorrow than what we see today. You know, to talk about credit cards as sort of the status quo, we have to remember that this is like a 40 or 50-year-old technology.
On the other hand, we shouldn't rule out the credit card companies as part of it, because they seem to have done a very, very savvy job of moving from plastic to computers doing the same kinds of business. So the technologies may change, but I'm not sure the players will change as much as all that.
Mm-hmm.
We have about a minute left. I'm going to take one more quick caller. Stan from Urbana, you're on the air on Focus. Stan, are you with me?
Yes. I think my question has to do with what you were just talking about, and that's the applicability of this system that's developed in Kenya for cell phone-based money transfers throughout the country there. Could you comment on that?
Well, I could very quickly. The one in Kenya is called M-Pesa, M for mobile. Pesa is Swahili for money. And what you're looking at is, like, in a period of 4 or 5 years, you have now like 17 million people who are storing value in an electronic account using this method, or sending funds to a merchant or to a loved one in the countryside by way of what is basically a text message. And this is having dramatic and positive effects on people's everyday lives and on the economy. But to speak to Charles's earlier point about who the players are, I think that's well taken, because there is also a lot of concern that if this is a mobile telecom operator who's providing this service to people, what's the regulatory framework to make sure that people's money stays there and that they don't get ripped off, or that if this telecom company suddenly wants to buy a baseball team and get out of the money storing and money transfer business,
where does that leave the value? Yes.
Where does that leave the value? So there are big questions, but there's also a tremendous amount of potential, I think, there.
We're going to have to end our conversation there. Our thanks to our callers. Our apologies for those who have been standing by. Our guests today on Focus have been David Wolman, author of The End of Money, published by DeCapo Press, and University of Illinois finance professor Charles Kann. Thank you both for being on Focus today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program. Go to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Wednesday on Focus, bees are facing increasing danger from colony collapse disorder, and that's bad news for the plants bees pollinate, including some vital crops. Next on Focus, we'll talk with U of I entomologist May Barenbaum about new findings that help scientists understand why bee colonies worldwide are collapsing. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580 with a replay at 8 p.m. And you can hear the show streamed or archived at will.illinois.edu. I'm Jim Meadows, Focus on WILL.